You're listening to Future Artifacts FM, a bi-monthly podcast and broadcast featuring speculative fiction audio works by artists and writers, produced and presented by Nina Davies,
Rebecca Edwards,
and Niamh Schmidtke on RTM,
and also available wherever you get your podcasts.
The program focuses on fictional works intended for broadcast to carve out a better understanding of the now by exploring various interpretations of the future.
Together with guests, we discuss the mechanics of different types of storytelling to reveal the complexities of contemporary culture. Let's get started.
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 This miniseries is commissioned by Henry Moore Institute to accompany their exhibition Phantasmagoria, Folkloric Sculpture for the Digital Age, open 15th May 2026 to 30th of August 2026.
For more information, just visit the Henry Moore Institute website.
The opinions expressed by contributors in this episode do not necessarily reflect the views of the Henry Moore Foundation, its trustees, employees, or associates.
Okay, welcome back to Future Artifacts FM. As per usual, I'm your host, Rebecca Edwards.
I'm Nina Davies.
And I'm Niamh Schmidtke.
Welcome to episode 37 and the third episode of our new mini-series with the Henry Moore Institute around their exhibition, Phantasmagoria, Folkloric Sculpture for the Digital Age. And we're here today with our second artist commission of this new mini-series, Sarah Al-Siraj. Welcome to the show, Sarah. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. We're recording this remotely again. And we have a super international group of artists for this miniseries, which is really great. And you're speaking with us from?
From Paris right now.
Amazing.
So just to, I'm just going to give a little introduction for our listeners. So Sarah Al-Siraj is a visual artist and cultural worker based between Pittsburgh and London. Her work centers on world building as a creative and critical process where painting and immersive technologies are understood as portals to other worlds. Predicated on the belief that our world was designed in service of imperial violence, she builds new life worlds rooted in land, spirit, and ancestry. Currently working with game engines, she's interested in appropriating military simulation technologies to build uncolonizable realms, inspired by global majority knowledge systems and emerging quantum thought. Her creative practice is informed by working in movements at organizations such as Forensic Architecture, the Inclusive Mosque Initiative, and Healing Justice London. She's inspired by the tangible material potential of visionary practice in global liberation movements, and she occasionally lends her hands to illustration and graphic design for various groups. And you've also got a long list of places that you've shown, which never lends itself great to radio, but we can confirm that Sarah has a great CV.
Thank you.
And we're really excited to have Sarah's work as part of these three artist commissions. And today we're really excited to be premiering a new work by Sarah called The Manjet, which is a 15-minute radio play. Before we listen to the work, which is a little over 15 minutes long, you were saying just before we started recording, Sarah, that the Manjet is the name of a boat. Can you expand on this a little bit just before we start to listen?
It's the name of an ancient Egyptian vessel, I think like a solar bark that's meant to, something to do with the afterlife, I think guiding people from one realm to the next.
Oh, so it's like a mythical, it's a mythical.
Yeah, mythical ship.
Well, as you listen to the work, you'll hear particularly why it's quite a helpful introduction into the piece in terms of thinking about water, thinking about realms. And I think we're very excited to be having a radio play again on the work kind of in this specific broadcast setting.
Sorry, you said that this project is an extension of your show at Eastside Projects, which is that still on or is that finished now?
It's finished. Hopefully it will be shown in more locations that work. But yeah, it was a commission from Eastside Projects. So it was really great to be able to expand it into a sound piece, like I guess my first sound piece, which we recorded at Mosaic Rooms, shout out.
Yeah. And what we're gonna do is we're gonna, in the show notes, we're gonna share a link to some of the visuals from the show. So if you want to take a look and kind of like see where like the sort of the genesis of where the sound work has come from, we urge you to take a look.
Yeah, really beautiful paintings in that show, Sarah. Huge paintings.
Yeah.
So we'll welcome you back in about 15 minutes and talk with Sarah more about the work.
Well, it has been a rather wet and windy 24 hours, and I'm afraid to say...
The very idea of dominating the natural world.
There are several flood alerts currently in force from the environment. As the River Am has burst turbines.
Stems from the domination of human by human. Human by human.
For 6 days and 6 nights, the wind has been... All mankind is turbulent.
Yeah, live from the tempestuous waters of East London, this is your host, Deep Sinker. You're locked in right now to the Manjet, where we talk everything current, monitoring the human costs of rising flood levels across the UK, including shrinking borders, migrations and local displacements, as well as adaptive acts and tidal subcultures coming straight from the people. Bo! Now, my dear listeners, we're going to be exploring the newly formed and very misunderstood community growing at the edges of society. Woo! Across the UK's eastern shores, we'll be having an exclusive live conversation with the Bitter River Collective, or the BRC as they're commonly called, exploring their practices of economic self-sufficiency, woo! Anarchist organising, yeah! And the most controversial of all, an escalation to violence in their recent environmental campaigns. Woo! Branded a terrorist organisation by the Home Secretary, we'll be speaking to their elusive and enigmatic leader, known only as Fatima, about their political philosophy, as well as their recent bombing of the Thames Water Barrier. But first, as always, our channels are open to you, yeah you, our listeners, to call in with your questions, concerns and daily shenanigans. Oh, looks like we have our first caller. Hello, caller number one. You're on the air. Please give us your name and location.
Yeah, this is Dan. Big fan, long-time listener.
Hi, Dan. Thank you for your support, mate. Where are you calling from?
So I'm from East Yorkshire, but me and my family are currently staying in temporary housing in Sheffield. We've been moved 3 times in the past 2 years, and honestly...
Wow, 3 times?
It's just getting ridiculous. We're all fed up. They keep saying they're controlling the water levels, that we'll be able to go back home eventually. Then after 6 months, we get a new flood warning. We have to pack everything up again.
Ah, man. I'm so sorry to hear that. I hope you and your family are staying safe up there, Dan. 3 times in 2 years. Hey, that's rough. Who's your family then, Dan?
Me, my parents, my auntie, my little cousins. You know, my parents, they're getting old and my cousins are supposed to be in school. We just can't keep moving like this, man.
Of course.
They keep saying, oh, soon, but it's just lip service. They said they'd clear the water and reinforce the flood barrier. But unless it's a financial district or a rich neighbourhood, those places, they're miraculously saved each time. And you think, well, if they can keep those low-lying places safe, why can't they keep our homes safe?
That is a great question, Dan. I think a lot of people resonate with what you're saying. Now, are you able to access clean drinking water?
There's a standpoint. It's round the corner. Our last place, it was miles away. You couldn't even access it by car. At this rate, I might as well join those terrorists at the coast. Anything's better.
Okay. Well, sending you strength and keeping your family in our prayers, Dan. We hope you get home soon, inshallah. Just a reminder to anyone calling in that any expression of intention to join proscribed or soon to be proscribed groups can be investigated by the state's counter-terror wing. Now, on to our next caller. Hello, caller number two. You are on the air. Give us your name and location, please.
Hi, it's Phoebe, she, her, calling in from Richmond.
Hi, Phoebe.
Yeah, I'm just calling in to say I think it's really upsetting that you're giving those terrorists a platform. What about those people they killed in the Thames bombing? One of them had kids, a construction worker. The Bitter River Collective are not some subversive liberation army like they claim. They have such a great idea for how to handle the flood crisis. They could cooperate with the civil service or with the scientists and engineers on the front lines trying to manage the devastation.
Right, Phoebe. I hear you.
They're using violence for the sake of optics. I think it's really disappointing you're giving them the space. You know, what about the people they've displaced with their little commune? People who've lived in those regions for generations, who've been told they basically have two options. Stay and live under a new regime, or leave and go looking for housing like everyone else.
Okay, Phoebe, thank you. You're raising some excellent points, and as always, the Manjet is a place for discussion, for discomfort, for growth, and nuance.
Oh.
Now, listeners, as promised, we have an exclusive interview with Fatima coming up. This will be the Mysterious Leader's first ever live interview. We'll be hearing all about the fight on the Eastern Shoreline after the break.
Thirsty? Surrounded by water with not a thing to drink? Aquapure water purification tablets have got you covered. Just pop one capsule into 250 milliliters of water and boom, thirst quenched. Sold at your local pharmacy. One pack of 10 capsules for only $9.99. Thirsty? Think Aquapure. Caution, water purified with Aquapure capsules may contain dangerous levels of chlorine if not properly diluted. Aquapure may cause serious eye irritation, respiratory irritation, and may release dangerous gases. Aquapure is toxic to aquatic life with long-lasting effects. Use biocide safely. Always read the label and product information before use.
Are you feeling lost? Like you're circling the drain with no end in sight? The Church of the Amniotic Waters teaches you how to take back control through ritual water worship. Join our fun, loving, and vibrant community and meet like-minded individuals seeking a greater connection. Get in touch with your inner convection and learn how to summon the rain. Go to www.amnioticwaters.org to find out more.
All right, we are back. I hope you guys are as excited as I am for our next interview with the Bitter River, a group promising to reorganize society along principles of environmental justice and equity. Hello, Fatima, are you with us?
Hello, yes.
Wow, hi. It's great to hear from you. We know we're very lucky to have you on the show, and we hope that this can be a chance for you to speak in your own words.
Thank you. We consider you an ally. We typically avoid public speaking so as to not have our message co-opted and distorted by the media. Our mission statement and demands are on everything we produce.
Right, yeah, so as you know, here on Amanjet, we consider ourselves to be the voice of the people. Now, I know you guys are currently in hiding for your own safety. Thank you for risking the call. Can you give us any information at all about your surroundings?
Let's just say the sun is setting. The starlings are roosting in the reeds.
Beautiful.
You can hear surveillance drones buzzing overhead.
Ah, Asgard. No way, that's tough, man. Now, the Home Secretary calls you lot terrorists. You're currently wanted for a list of offences including unauthorised occupation of private property, violent disorder, destruction of protected infrastructure, and most notably, the criminal damage and sabotage of the Thames Barrier control system, resulting in the deaths of 4 civilians. To these, man, you're just what they've been looking for. Heroes of an environmental disaster, risen out of the ashes of decades of austerity in the legacy of militant resistance groups of the past. And to other people, your methods are reckless, dangerous, violent, unnecessarily so. So what do you say to people? People like caller number 2, who think your group is violent?
Our group is violent. To those who find our methods unsavoury, we generally believe that the huge displacement of the masses, the most vulnerable in British society, including the sick and the elderly, to protect a chosen few, is violent. And the Thames Barrier? The state's response to mass flooding and displacement was not protecting the people. It was protecting London elites and government officials from the consequences of the climate crisis that they helped create. Every day we have people coming, travelling from across the country to join our community. People who are struggling to live.
Right. So there are a lot of people listening from home right now who I'm sure resonate with what you're saying, yeah? Still, there are those who'd say that the Bitter River just takes things a few steps too far. Now, what would you say to those who feel that any loss of life is just too great a cost for the system change that you're promising? That this just isn't the way. That's creating more chaos and that there might be more, you know, peaceful, diplomatic ways of going about it.
peaceful diplomacy. Wow. Well, we would say that you can't fight a violent system with negotiation when there is blood on the negotiating table. Please remember that in our case, the state was the first aggressor, sending huge armored vehicles, destroying our homes, poisoning our water supplies, threatening our food security and attempting to drain our marshes when they should be draining the streets of their cities. As I mentioned, there are drones overhead, which we regularly shoot down. We live under near constant surveillance. I don't want to argue about violence. Decolonization is always a violent phenomenon.
Decolonization, what? Is that Fanon, yeah? Some people might say, well, we're in England. What does this conversation have to do with decolonization?
Do you read history?
Do
you know the history of the land enclosure in this country? The wetlands we inhabit used to be a commons, owned by the people. You know who used to live there?
What, English people, innit?
The Fen Tigers. Described by the history books as a primitive, wild, uncivilized society. And you know why? Because they had their own way of living. In harmony with the land, they had their own economies. There were farmers, fishermen. And you know what the state did with their Dutch engineers to civilize the wild people? They dug ditches and installed gates. They turned millions of acres of marshland into privately owned agricultural land. You can read about it. They used to call it the greatest environmental disaster the country had ever seen. Now we are living in the greatest environmental disaster the country's ever seen.
Okay, so what? They successfully drained the marshes and then the water returned?
With the flood, and so did we. Since we moved here, huge numbers of migratory species have returned.
And you're at risk of being drained, you say?
Yes. Yes. You know, you mentioned Fanon. Like he said, our most essential value, first and foremost, is the land. Or, for us, the water. And just like the previous inhabitants of this land who resisted for hundreds of years, we will resist this. They didn't need state control and neither do we. We build what we need. What we can't build, we trade with our allies overseas. We have a food program. We have doctors. We provide free childcare and schooling for children.
You mentioned people joining you. Can I ask, what sort of people?
I can't say.
Okay, well, what would one need to do to join your group?
To live among us. To participate according to your capabilities. To be a member of our community. And in return, we provide.
Can you share a bit about your policy on immigration?
We don't have a policy on immigration because we don't have borders. We lie in a borderless expanse of interconnected marshes, but we inhabit the coastline. So when migrants arrive, we lead them to safety.
The Home Secretary has accused you of hacking into two migrant processing centres, causing the entire system to collapse. Huge amounts of data gone, waiting times increased, vulnerable people at risk of deportation.
Those processing centres were detention camps for climate displaced people. No one was deported. We liberated those facilities and offered anyone who wanted the opportunity to join us.
Some would argue that's not much of a choice.
Look, right now, there's not much difference between non-British so-called immigrants and British so-called citizens. Look around. 17% of the country are living out of a suitcase. And if we define the borders by the coastline, which is historically how it has been defined, then it's a much smaller state than what it was pre-flood and shrinking smaller still.
Right.
Now you have a land problem, a space problem. You have 17% of the country internally displaced. You have overcrowding. Now what happens when there's another epidemic? People living in cramped conditions. Who do you think is going to be safe on a shrinking island? You know where they used to put migrants? On giant prison boats. The water is where they put everything that they do not want to see. But it's everywhere now. And swallowing everything. Some people have come here just because they'd rather accept this as a new reality. Learn how to navigate by boat, how to catch fish. And so we are practicing for the first time in modern history, a borderless state, one that cannot be invaded by armoured vehicles.
Yeah, the Home Secretary and much of the mainstream media has called the Bitter River a terrorist organisation. Do you have a response to that?
How do you define a terrorist?
Answering questions with a question.
We can show our next target.
What, target?
Britannia Water.
What? When you say target...
Britannia Water are responsible for the diversion of millions of litres of purified water to private data centres, while our children drink contaminated flood water. They discharge untreated wastewater into flood-affected areas, killing ecosystems that communities rely on. They're distribution points, neglect communities who need it the most, sometimes forcing people to walk miles for clean water.
All right. Hey. Remember we spoke.
Collecting data at their water distribution points and selling it to the government, tracking the movement of marginalized communities.
All right. Hey.
If they do not stop, we will attack their headquarters.
Hello? Fatima, hello? Right, well, it appears we've lost them. That was our show, guys. Be sure to tune in next week. This is The Man Jet every Thursday on Radio Current.
Okay, welcome back. You just heard The Man Jet by Sarah El-Sarraj. Sarah, to kick things off, I was wondering whether you could introduce us to this world a little bit. As the work progresses, more of this world is revealed to us, whether it's via the host or the regional accents of the callers phoning in. A map slowly starts to formulate in my imagination. This is obviously set in the UK, but the landscape sounds like it has changed considerably and might be set in a not too distant future. Thinking about your work with game engines and as an artist, how did you build this world?
So it really all started with this commission from Eastside Projects, and I kind of like at the very beginning sort of pitched the project as like, I want to go into the archive and I want to find all of these moments, historical moments of resistance that may not have been kind of fully recorded. And then I started doing some kind of archival research, but a lot of what I was finding, I guess I was kind of interested in finding things which were more related to global majority solidarities. But I think that with a lot of global majority struggles, especially post-colonial struggles, a lot of it was related to like land and resource and stuff like that. And then I was reading this book called War-Torn Ecologies, and I was kind of thinking about the kind of lessons that can be learned from global majority eco-resistance, and I was then started to look at eco-resistance histories within the UK, and that kind of took me to researching this history in the east of England and this kind of history of drainage, and then looking at, because a lot of my work is kind of inevitably becomes kind of speculative, I guess, or becomes kind of this sort of urge to world build and storytell. I found these flood prediction maps of the UK, so you could like kind of change the dials depending on, like, you know, if global warming continues as it's going and the kind of worst scenarios and like large parts of the UK would be submerged by water, which is already starting to happen now. So I was kind of looking at this future map of the UK, and then I started to imagine, okay, well, what if this kind of all of these kinds of wetland resistance movements, what if a future flooded UK made a lot of them become possible again? And I was thinking a lot about the kind of communities that I'm in and like eco-anarchism, and just imagining that a lot of people would move to these wetlands, to these new future flooded lands, instead of kind of trying to go further and further upland. What would it mean to kind of like embrace these wetlands and build a kind of autonomous community there in a kind of similar way to how people did in the past with the UK's wetlands, how Fenland people did in the past.
That reminds me of, have you seen, I saw on TikTok, there's like a pub somewhere like off the Thames, I think it's like more inland, which like one of its like advertising, like how they advertise the pub is that like halfway through the day when the tide comes up, the pub floods.
Oh, wow.
And it's like kind of done almost like in this like almost like it's like a bougie it's thing.
Glamorizing flooding.
Interesting.
There was this essay, which we're also kind of researching for another episode as part of this mini-series by this writer, Roisin Agnew, which is called Bog Communism. And I guess in Ireland, like the wetland would be the bog. And one of the things she talks about is during their Cromwellian plantations in Ireland, which is one of the more violent ones, Cromwell famously saying kind of to hell or to Connacht, and forcing Irish people who wouldn't assimilate to the part of the country that was kind of the least possible to grow food. Many people fled to the bogs because the British, the planters, didn't know how to navigate those lands, but the Irish did, having grown with them. So in terms of thinking about the wetland as a space of resistance, also in terms of the role of navigation, which I think is then interesting when we talk about the title of the work being the Manjet, being kind of this mythical vessel to travel through water. There's something about the relationship to land in terms of how knowledge of land is learnt, is passed down, and becomes sort of in, let's say, the part of the land that is not typically considered the most desirable. I mean, here in this pub on the Thames, it's sort of, it feels like a satire to be like, oh, let's embrace the flood, when it's actually a really damaging thing. It means that people, like shop owners, typically lose loads and loads of money because they can't be insured for floodplain zones, you know, and then typically those who can afford the rents are those who have the least ability to replace stock, let's say. And that's not even talking about housing, and that's talking about it in the Western world. But I think there's something about, in this work, how you talk about these marshlands, these wetlands, as spaces where kind of otherwise or possibility emerges. Both the resistance of sort of being pushed into that space in terms of not having another variety of land to live safely in, but when placed in that means sort of, yeah, what types of kind of resistance or what types of living with become possible.
Yeah, it's really interesting. One of the kind of main inspirations for me was this essay by Amina Salati on efflux, and it's called Wetlands of Resistance. Really brilliant essay where she's talking about the marshes of southern Iraq and how it was the kind of marshland communities, the marsh Arabs, the Ahwar, inhabit these marshes. And during the 1990s, Saddam drained these marshes as a means of kind of, there was a lot of sort of rebels hiding among the reeds in the marshes. So there is kind of this like history globally with wetlands, I think, because they're impenetrable by armored vehicles, because their borders are constantly changing with the seasons, and because the reeds in wetlands are often difficult to see through with radar and stuff like that, they become these kinds of spaces that rebel groups, or like, even I think there's a history of like marinage and people escaping to marshes. So there's a really kind of interesting global connected history of people who inhabit wetlands building a sort of autonomous, independent, self-sufficient livelihoods and ways of being and economies, and that being viewed very negatively by the state that wishes to kind of centralize and hold power and assimilate these communities into a larger sort of nation state effort.
So when you talk about the draining of these marshlands, is the purpose of draining them to regain control over those areas, when you're saying that, like, because marshlands can't be occupied or entered by like military vehicles, for example?
I guess it's kind of twofold, because in the case of the UK, drainage started, I think, in the mid 1600s, and it was partially to kind of like assimilate these quote-unquote wild and primitive people who lived in these marshlands. See, it was really interesting for me because when I was reading all of this like literature, I realized that it was a very kind of colonial language that was used to describe these people who live in the fens. And so it's partially to kind of like assimilate these communities, and partially because marshlands, wetlands are kind of like carbon sinks. So they store a lot of, I guess, like carbon in the soil, and they're extremely fertile land once drained. So drainage in the UK was kind of turned these sort of free-flowing marshes into agricultural productive land. So there was kind of like a agro-industrial purpose for that kind of drainage. And with Iraq, like, you can find British documents where they're discussing what to do with these marshes in the south of Iraq. So there's a lot of technology. The kind of drainage technology, I think it emerged from, I think it was a Dutch engineer who came up with this technology and then gave it to Britain, and then when the UK had administrative control over a lot of parts of the global majority, there was also this consideration of like, what do we do with these wetlands that we find here? How can we maybe make them productive? Should we install a dam and things like that? Which, yeah, is really an interesting kind of link to how this kind of technology moves through these kinds of like means of control around the globe.
The story and situation is told through multiple perspectives. The radio host, caller number one, who's frustrated by being relocated several times. Caller number two, who is unhappy with the platforming of the Bitter River Collective. The two kind of ads that you have after that, that kind of are almost like the in-between of the caller section and the main host, who is Fatima, the leader of the Bitter River Collective, and then of course the radio show host. Do you feel like these characters and ads represent the world as you've designed it, or do you feel like there's aspects of the world that you've left out because you couldn't fit them in, or whether like you've purposefully left out within the work?
Honestly, I think there's definitely loads of the world that I've left out. I think that there's this thing that happens with world building, which is, I think, slightly more associated with literature. When I come up with ideas for things, I generate like a huge amount of text and like fake kind of like newspapers. And when I was working with Eastside, it was like I made so much writing and they were like, we can't include all of this, like we can't have like, you know, many, many pages of exhibition handouts for this mostly visual work. So I think like I come up with a lot of different, I guess, ideas, and then I start thinking about what kind of represents the range of different opinions within this world. When I was younger, I remember reading The Sound and the Fury, and there was like this gigantic appendix that Faulkner had written, and it was like 1,000 pages or something, where he had just kind of kept going with these characters and what happens to them. But I think in selecting the kind of conversation that was had in this radio play and selecting which kinds of characters would be the protagonists, I kind of wanted to select things that would best mirror and kind of like hold a lens to things, to kind of relevant discussions happening today.
Where did these characters come from, or like, did you base these characters on kind of anyone specifically? I mean, I'm assuming they're probably all amalgamations of like loads of people or things that you've come across. Mm. When you say there's a main character, I mean, obviously Fatima is the main character, but also I feel like when I'm listening, I do feel like the radio host is kind of also like a main supporting character.
Yeah. I spent the most time trying to kind of develop the radio host character. I was kind of imagining in this sort of future world that this radio show would be something that people kind of regularly listen to, and kind of, you know, like a sort of host that people feel very like held by, and that this radio show would be a kind of a container for like, I think he even says that at one point, like, we consider ourselves to be like the voice of the people. So I was kind of imagining it to be kind of like a anarchist radio show. And quite interestingly, in some of my research, I found that at a time when the BBC kind of had a monopoly on broadcast and radio in the UK, I think in like the 60s, the kind of pirate radio stations, a lot of them were operating offshore on boats because they were technically outside of like UK jurisdiction.
Oh, like pirate radio.
Yeah, yeah.
Quite like literally pirates.
Yeah, yeah. But the host, it was actually a really great working relationship, because when I kind of developed these characters, I was like, I really need to find people, because I don't know voice actors. I was like, I need to find people who can like quite authentically embody these characters and bring the right kind of energy. So for the radio host, the voice actor is Reza Tariq, and he just does an absolutely fantastic job. When we were recording it, he was like kind of adding notes and like, think kind of like really took on that character and sort of was part of the development of that quite distinct like voice and energy. And then when I was writing the character of Fatima, who I would say is kind of like this main character, kind of tried to build up some suspense in the script for like, you know, she's coming, and then we get to hear her. I was watching a lot of interviews with like resistance fighters and kind of revolutionary leaders. So I was like watching interviews with like Angela Davis and Ghassan Kanafani and some other figures whose names I might not mention, and just thinking kind of like particularly following the sort of cadence of the conversation, like the way that it would begin, you know, maybe there'd be some kind of coy remarks, and then it would kind of, so the way that I wrote it was that there are moments where that character, she kind of erupts into like very clear, concise language where she's speaking with a certain kind of confidence so as not to be misunderstood, and a kind of like, I guess like the main word is like conviction. And when I was writing the vocal descriptions, I was like, that is really the word for this character. So I was kind of, yeah, basing it on these resistance fighters and revolutionary leaders of the past, and just the way in which they speak with so much clarity to like very clearly get the point across. Which, interestingly, as I was like doing this research, I kind of realized that I think that in today's media, a lot of the way in which people are interviewed, there is such a strong agenda from the kind of interviewer that like it's so difficult for people to actually be given space to talk.
Yeah, the amount of interviews I've seen where it's just like the struggle,
yeah,
of the guest, yeah, trying to put the interviewer back in their place, and yeah, it just, and then, and to this point where they end up not talking about anything because it ends up just, yeah, becoming about this struggle of the two people talking, just trying to get their opinion or their angle. Like, well, I guess the interviewer is trying to get their angle in, and the interviewee is just trying to answer the question.
Yeah, but I think especially when you have media sources like the BBC, because a lot of kind of major media outlets in the UK are owned by people with, let's say, more conservative politics, it's kind of basic terminology that you're using in many of those conversations when you're talking about politics or like resistance movements. You can kind of see even in the way in which the BBC speaks, or rather doesn't speak, about Palestine.
Yeah.
And whenever you have people coming on air to then discuss that there is a genocide happening, you know, and it's despite kind of multiple global organizations also making declarations, also stating that there are war crimes, you know, it's not, it's been sort of, let's say, backed up by these institutions that we typically trust. There's still a resistance, and it becomes an argument over terminology rather than the very real violence that is happening. And I think what's interesting here is that the fact that you're using it as like this pirate or this anarchist radio space is that the radio host is actually having a conversation with Fatima, you know? Mm. He's not pushing her down, or he's not trying to shut down the points that she's making. He's pushing back and almost in trying to be a representative of his listenership as well. You know, he's saying, you know, like this woman who's stating she agrees that the politics of that future of the UK is wrong, but she disagrees with the violence that this collective is enacting. And maybe before you come in, I'll use that to kind of jump into the third question, which you've answered parts of, but I think it might be nice to contextualize it even more in the research that you've been doing, you know, in the fact that, you know, we are teased with hearing from Bitter Collective's leader, we're teased with like hearing from Fatima, and you're talking about the specific cadence of her voice, and she speaks explicitly to the violent actions that her collective has been doing, you know, the bombing of infrastructure, which has also led to loss of life as a form of environmental activism, as forms of direct action. And it was reminding me of things such as the arson attacks that the Earth Liberation Front did during the 90s, who were for a time the most wanted terrorists in the US. It's making me think about groups like the Black Panthers or the suffragettes movements back in the UK in the early 1910s. And more specifically, she's referencing Fanon's Decolonization is Always Violent from his book, The Wretched of the Earth. I wanted to ask a bit more about how you developed, I mean, Fatima's character, you know, you're talking about Angela Davis as a reference point, but I guess also maybe some of the policies behind the Bisher River Collective, and maybe where some of those ideas have come from. You know, are you thinking about, I guess, these historical direct action groups, or are there other places that, let's say, the policy that's driven them towards enacting such violence, or kind of the way they feel that they need to do that type of violence?
So part of my kind of, within my research, I was reading and also watching this chapter in The Wretched of the Earth. There's like a film that was made based on it, and it's like really excellent. It's narrated by Lauryn Hill, and it kind of looks at all of these kind of different like workers' struggles in Africa that are sort of very closely linked with colonialism and companies and extraction of resources and things like that, and how people are kind of like organizing against that, and like the role of violence, and it interviews some like Western colonizers. And I guess I was kind of looking at this, what feels like a very topical debate around the use of violence by the oppressed, and the kind of debates that are like often had in, I think particularly like the Western world, around kind of like whether that is permissible for oppressed people to be using violence, but then like just like the intense hypocrisy of that conversation, because often those having that conversation are not experiencing the kind of deep structural direct and indirect violence that is, you know, oppression, land dispossession, economic violence, like all of these very sharp experiences, racialized violence, white supremacy, ableist violence. Like, I think often these debates are had by individuals who are not, you know, experiencing that. And, you know, everything happening today in this country around the prescription of certain groups who are carrying out direct action in accordance with international human rights law and things like that. And so I was kind of trying to like unpack a lot of these terms that we use, like violence, and what do we consider violence to be, and the way that it is really, it's kind of, the idea of violence becomes very individualized and becomes about one person and another person as like, you know, these four civilian deaths in an encounter to like the probably in this future world, you know, hundreds if not thousands of deaths that emerge through more indirect means, or even, you know, just like in the UK, the loss of like 100,000 people during COVID to ableist, violent, inadequate policies. So there's kind of a discussion around what we consider violence to be, and also kind of a discussion around what we consider terrorism to be, and how that term is really mobilized and weaponized to refer to, you know, in a very racialized way, to refer to specific groups who are moving, you know, in contrast to like the state, and often building power and building community, and, you know, doing work, like doing a lot of support work, but it's seen as this huge threat, and there's like this sort of inordinate response, securitization and surveillance and things like that. And even in my research, looking at how, you know, we often associate terrorism with like Islamic extremism, but that's actually a fairly new phenomenon that was actually heavily pushed by, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu, who was the first person to try and, I think, held like a summit in the US, or maybe it was in Israel, which was to try and align terrorism with Islamic extremism very specifically. And then the way that that kind of language, the way that terrorism as an idea kind of continued to gain prominence and is selectively applied. So I guess I was looking at how both violence and terrorism are these kind of terminologies that get very pulled and twisted and mobilized, you know, as with like the war on terror within the media, things like that, I guess.
Once you start to use the term terrorist, it dismantles or it takes away any, let's say, power of what a prescribed organization is trying to demonstrate. You know, even in the UK, it is an offense to show support for any prescribed group. But I think then, in terms of what those organizations, I guess I'm part of what I'm thinking about is things like the IRA, and like in Irish history, the IRA comes from what was the resistance army that gained Irish independence in the 1920s. And then you had the sort of the progression of the provisional IRA, which were obviously incredibly violent and were specifically targeting people. As soon as you prescribe an organization like that, there's a part of it where, let's say, the history of Irish independence becomes complicated in a way where you are unable to celebrate Irish independence because it's wrapped up in this organization that are terrorists or are labeled as such. And so I think the thing is, when you're talking about these forms of violence, is also about what types of violence are we discussing? Because let's say in the case of Northern Ireland, when we talk about the violence that the British state has done in Northern Ireland, we're able to talk about that freely. But when we talk about it from, let's say, those who are resisting it, we can't speak about that freely. And so it stops the conversation. It stops the ability to like talk about it in this nuanced way, as happens in this radio play. You know, he's trying to have a nuanced conversation with Fatima. How do we come to a point where we can resolve, or how do we come to a point where we can have a conversation, rather than, let's say, just separating out and saying, no, this is the line we cannot discuss.
Yeah.
You know, that the violence of that, I guess I'm thinking.
Of that kind of censorship. Within this whole kind of conversation, there's actually a book by Suhaima Mansour Khan called Tangled in Terror, and she's speaking about her experience as a Muslim woman, as a Muslim hijabi woman. And I think she kind of comes to this conclusion, if I'm recalling correctly, that's like, we just should not be using this word of terrorist and terrorism, because like, you know, historically, like Nelson Mandela was considered a terrorist, right? So when things eventually prevail, history is kind of rewritten from a very different vantage point. Yeah.
Sarah, in the work, the interview with Fatima raises questions about who controls access to water and how resistance movements are framed as either legitimate political actors or as threats. And within this framing, the work also references the enclosure of marshlands and struggles over access to clean drinking water. I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about why water became the central focus of this project. And I'm also interested in whether you were thinking about more recent examples such as water privatization. You know, Fatima talks about the drainage of the English fens in the 17th century and the resistance of the fen tigers. But I was, yeah, wondering if there are other historical events that you were influenced by whilst you were imagining the Bitter River Collective.
I guess, as I've said, like marshlands often become this kind of site of resistance. And there were kind of things, I guess there were kind of things converging while I was making these drawings for Eastside Projects, relating to water, specifically relating to water as like a kind of boundaryless entity which moves kind of according to its own logic. So while I was making the works, I had a friend of mine was on the Samud Freedom Flotilla, and she was kind of like sending these long messages, and there were some messages that she was sending which was talking about how being on this experience for her of being on this boat really made her understand like how futile and ridiculous borders are. And I think in the UK, as an island, as a group of islands, I think we have a very strange kind of relationship to water, where we kind of, I don't know, you know, there's this like colonial history of like Britannia rules the waves, and this kind of relationship to very defensive borders in the UK. And so the idea of a future flood that actually shrinks the country or starts to like engulf the country, and the kind of response to that of people to either kind of like, I guess in my head, thinking that people would either move further inland and, you know, be part of this like internally displaced community on dry land, or sort of embrace the water and go outwards and be, you know, learn to kind of like have a more, I guess, like island kind of experience, or like a more kind of like water informed way of being, is kind of what I was imagining would happen. And yeah, it's interesting when I was really looking into the history of the fen tigers. It's a very interesting kind of terminology, because the tiger actually comes from like a French word. It's not the British word tiger. It's like a French word that means peasant, but then it kind of evolved in Cambridgeshire to refer to this like elusive, like I think big cat that people saw kind of like stalking around. And then from Cambridgeshire, there were like a couple of boxers who were like really good, I think like boxers, maybe wrestlers, and they were referred to as like the fen tiger, this person. So there's kind of something interesting about, I guess, like the sort of, I don't know, mythologies that emerge around these communities and these kind of water-based communities.
It's funny, I've just been looking into like lost forms of embodied knowledge and like what happens like in sort of what kinds of industries or crafts or like what, and like what does it mean to lose a sort of embodied knowledge in terms of a skill or something. And one of the big ones that they were talking about was ships.
Yeah.
Like being, obviously some people still do use sails or like make ships out of wood, but they were saying like, you know, when you're working with a craftsperson or someone's like a master is teaching you their trade, there's usually like there'll be the line of like, you'll know it when it feels right, which is not something that like a book can teach you. And then they were talking about like, and so what happens, so like when I guess these practices of like sailing, like using the stars as a form of navigation, having a really embodied knowledge of like a relation to water and wind, and what happens like when those masters, let's say, like aren't around anymore and there's no one to learn these things off, do we lose that form of embodied knowledge in relation to water and wind? And I think there was something when you were just talking about this potential rise of sort of like a more kind of island life, could there eventually be kind of a return, or I guess maybe like a reinvention, potentially would have to learn this for ourselves, but like a new kind of form of embodied knowledge in relation to the water and potentially the wind or whatever kind of other resources, not resources, but I guess the elements.
I think what you're talking about as well, Nina, sort of like the development of folk, of folklore, of like folk art in terms of like the boat building.
There's something really interesting about the kind of like, I guess, for me, the kind of relationship between folk and like migration, because I think we typically consider folk to be this historical thing that really relates to like, I guess, like a kind of indigenous presence. And in this work, I was kind of trying to marry this idea of like a deep knowledge and relationship to the land, but also one that welcomes people. And like, you know, especially thinking of like water, it's kind of inevitable for me that you'd think about immigration and like the kind of, you know, stop the boats being this prevailing rhetoric. And I was kind of imagining that, you know, there's a kind of a question in the debate where the radio host asks Fatima about, you know, their policy on immigration, and she says like, you know, we are like providing this service where we're also, you know, rescuing migrants because we live on boats, like we consider ourselves to be this kind of water people, and so we want to, you know, welcome people into this sort of borderless commune that we're kind of trying to build. Something for me that I think you can see a bit more in the visual work that I made as part of this is the kind of like the way that I've illustrated people and the, you know, the things that are incorporated within that. I think it kind of starts to become, things start to become kind of like a life way or a custom, but in a way that incorporates, I think, like a lot of the contemporary things that we have today. So like in the drawing, there's like, you know, people are wearing like old hard drives as like necklaces because like presumably they carry the memory of their like, you know, parents or grandparents, but they're water damaged, so they just kind of hold like a symbolic presence. So I'm kind of interested, I guess, in, I mean, it doesn't really come through so much in the radio play, maybe a little bit in the second advert, which is like a sort of water cult idea that I'm kind of developing, but you know, it's kind of trying to imagine in this future, what are all of these strange, interesting, eccentric ways in which people will start to make new meaning of their relationships and their positionality and their kind of like identity through this very different landscape.
But I think also that the folklore you're talking about, it's emerging due to their conditions in terms of, it's not something that's specific to, oh, my ancestors were on this land. You know, it's not related to that sort of like essentialism that I think can be attributed to certain varieties of folk, you know, in terms of like, all of your family must have come from this nation, otherwise you are unable to practice this form of folk. Or even that it will change and morph over time based on the people who continue to practice as well, you know, that it's something that is moving, is changing, is always growing, as you're saying, kind of, if we have these forms of media and these forms of technologies that become kind of archival in a way, like we're not using them for their original intended purpose, you know, how would we use them in the future? You know, like I'm almost thinking about things like floppy disks from the late 90s. They're largely irrelevant now. You know, how might those objects be picked up in the next 50 years when their use, their original use form, becomes kind of devoid from the object itself? We understand that it's kind of a carrier of media, but we have no way in which to access it. I'm wondering if that maybe slightly segues into this question that we've been thinking about in this mini-series in terms of folklore in the present, you know, how it changes. What kind of folk influenced the world of this work? And are there, like, I'm thinking in particular of like these quite tongue-in-cheek advertisements that we have, like these water purification tablets, this kind of meditation that you're asking people to do, you know, so as though they can sort of will away structural violence. Are there particular customs or cultures that impacted the dialogue of these characters and kind of, let's say, the world that they inhabit?
I guess, like, even in the kind of way that the radio show speaks, and the kind of, like, language that he uses, there is kind of, like, a lot of water references, I guess. It's interesting, I think, with folk practices, because I think that, like, by and large, in this future world, people are kind of, like, as I said, kind of, like, on this boundary between people who are, like, living on land and people who, you know, the Bitter River Collective, who have, like, a bit more of an aquatic way of living. And I think there's a point in it where she says, you know, like, people join us and they learn to catch fish and, you know, they learn to, like, have the, you know, be part of this kind of community that we're building. And I think that we are, like, very deeply removed from the land in a lot of kind of contemporary, especially, like, city living often. You know, like, everybody wants to be a villager, but nobody wants to live in a village kind of thing. And when I think of folk and I think of this idea of, you know, just being of the people and not being kind of institutionalized, not being put in like a glass box, but these practices which are largely about survival and about heritage and about kind of like, you know, just like living and being, I think that there's almost like this kind of dichotomy presented in the work, perhaps, where there's this sort of bleak vision of the future where like people are encouraged to have like these kind of scary, absurdist water purification tablets which have like loads of warning side effects, and then this kind of like alternative that we're being sort of offered, which is to kind of like return to land in a way. And I think it's interesting because we're talking about folk and these practices that get lost, but then I think so many of them actually can kind of come back from erasure once we like actually do begin to physically practice being engaged with the land and, you know, growing things and understanding like the environments around us and things like that, you know.
Thank you so much, Sarah. We could have really spoken for another hour. There's many amazing people that have helped you voice this work.
Yeah, I would like to say a special thank you to my voice actors, Reza Tariq, Elsie, Yasmin Al-Arbaei, Ashabad Roy and Rosemary Moss, as well as Sigrun Salmanian and Angelina Radakovich from the Mosaic Rooms.
Sarah, do you have anything that you want to make our listeners aware of? Anything you have coming up or any other kind of events or showings that you'd like people to come to? Or also, if not, do you have any plans of where you're going to take this work, this sort of radio play? Do you see it evolving in some sort of way? Or, yeah.
Well, hopefully the kind of drawing associated with this work will be coming to London at some point, maybe this year. And for the radio play, honestly, now that I've like got a taste for it, I am thinking of maybe like, should I make more episodes? Should I keep kind of expanding this world?
I think definitely you should. I mean, if you do decide to extend this series, you should definitely get in touch with us and we can either advertise it on the website, on your page, or just keep the conversation going. So definitely,
we'd love to have you back.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks, great. Sarah. Thank you. It's been great. Thank you for being part of this miniseries as part of the Henry Moore Institute's exhibition, Phantasmagoria, Folkloric Sculpture for the Digital Age.
We have one more episode after Sara's, which will be coming out in August. We look forward to having you back, and we hope you enjoyed this episode. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.